on the Bond Chance. Jasmine Chance looked at the numbers. New memberships were up, way up, but not nearly at the levels that CyberNation wanted. It had been a good campaign, the combination pushes, but it had pretty much peaked. She leaned back in the chair and sighed. Well, she expected it to come to this. None of the governments they had lobbied were ready to step on board. There hadn't been enough of a public clamor, and that was what it was going to take. So it was time to step up things enough so that an outraged public would demand that those people who did their elected bidding get off the stick and fix things. Chance and her team had to give them something to fix, something it would take them a lot of time and money and effort to make right. And that meant taking down more than computer networks with software. It meant taking down hardware. And whether it was cutting cables or blowing up buildings, whatever it took was whatever it took. She looked at her watch. Keller's team would need to be told the schedule was being moved up again. Roberto would be tickled. He could cut loose, pull out all the stops, and that's what had always attracted him about this project. That and the money, of course. Joe's Diner, Kansas City, Kansas, June 1955. Joe's Diner was a classic, or it would be if it survived to the 1980s. Shaped like a fat hot dog bun, the front was glass from waist height up. Inside, a counter with boomerang patterns on the formica ran the length of the place and was utilized by sitting upon bolted-to-the-floor chrome-plated stools with red naugahyde covering the padded tops. Joe's served burgers, fries, and toasted cheese sandwiches for lunch. For dinner, the blue plate special was sliced roast beef, mashed potatoes, both covered with thick gravy, and your choice of a vegetable, as long as it was canned green peas or diced carrots. For breakfast, you could get ham and eggs, bacon and eggs, or sausage and eggs, and they all came with hash browns. If you were looking for health food, you'd starve to death in Joe's, and nobody would feel sorry for you. Only some kind of commie queer ate nothing but vegetables, and good riddance if he croaked. Since it was early, Jay was having breakfast. Jay glanced at his watch and then at the door just as the newspaper guy from the Kansas City Star arrived. This was a jaunty-looking fellow wearing a gray fedora and carrying a manila folder. Here was Mahler, ace reporter for the Star, a metaphor for the information transfer Jay needed. "Hey, Joe," Mahler said. "Coffee and the number three. My Oriental friend here is buying." Joe, the swarthy, heavy-set counterman in a once-white apron, nodded. Joe poured a cup of coffee into a heavy china mug and set it down on a saucer in front of Mahler. Some of the thin brew, it looked more like weak tea, slopped into the saucer. Mahler spooned 4 teaspoons of sugar into the cup, poured a little glass bottle of cream into it, stirred the concoction a couple of times, then sipped at it. Starbucks would have a field day here. Amazing they weren't all diabetics, too. "So here's your information," Mahler said. He slid the folder across the counter toward Jay. "Thanks. No problem. Anything I can do to keep those red bastards at bay, you just call." Jay smiled. The 50s were full of people worrying that the communists would be storming ashore at Palisades Park or Long Beach at any moment. For a time, anybody who considered himself a patriot would do anything for any government agency who hinted it would help stem the red tide threatening to engulf the world. "Your government thanks you, Mr. Mahler." Jay opened the folder. He scanned the list, nodded at the names, and smiled again. The boss was going to love this. Mahler's breakfast arrived, and it was positively psychedelic-looking. Bright yellow scrambled eggs, reddish-brown strips of crisp bacon, a stack of pancakes the diameter of a saucer piled 8 high, and a second plate with 4 pieces of toast cut in half diagonally, each buttered with 8 more pats of butter in a tiny bowl. Man. Jay had done the research. They really did eat like this. It was a wonder any of them had lived to be 30. NetForce HQ. Michaels was in his office trying to make sense of the new budget sheet his controllers had put together when Jay walked in. Nobody knocked around here. What did he have a secretary for? She never even tried to slow Jay down, far as he could tell.
Check it out, boss.
Jay handed Michaels the flat screen and flopped onto the couch.
They got a boatload of computer programmers on that ship. Bet your ass that's where the attacks on the web came from.
And you know this how?
Well, I was gonna rascal the personnel files for Cybernation, but Julio talked me out of it. Being as how that would be illegal, immoral, and probably fattening and all that. But he got me thinking, and I dug it out using public stuff. Perfectly legal.
Dug what out, exactly?
Okay, look at the list. What I did was, I borrowed a couple of hours on the BFS machine at NSA and ran a bunch of INEST records through them.
Michaels nodded. BFS was the Cray computer nicknamed the Big Fucking Sorter at the National Security Agency's newly refurbished underground complex outside Fairfax. INEST was the International Education Statistics Terminal mainframe based in D.C.
Okay.
And what I did was, I ran the top 2% of grads from top computer schools in the U.S. and Europe for the last 10 years. I found out who they were, then crossed them with public records. Driver's licenses, property taxes, income tax, like that.
I'm still listening, but I'm getting older here. We getting to a point? I'll stipulate you are a brilliant fellow. Jay laughed.
Well, okay. So what it comes down to is a whole bunch of these guys and girls who were the wonder kids of their graduating classes at CIT, MIT, Zurich U, U of Q, and all, seem to have taken up official residence in Geneva, Switzerland. Doesn't mean that they all work for Cybernation, of course, but the brightest of that bunch have been spending time and money in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, for the last 6 months. They went to Switzerland, then to Florida.
Which means?
Guess whose gambling ship has half a dozen flights from its deck to Fort Lauderdale each and every day? And records I can access show these folks tend to show up in the same cycle each week. I make that their days off. They live and work on the ship, hop the copter, and fly to town for Saturday R&R.
Michaels nodded. Circumstantial, but a really big coincidence if that's what it was. Occam's razor would slice that one to confetti.
I can nail it down some more, but I think we've got a nest of programmers and weavers on that ship, and they are taking some trouble to keep it quiet, if not absolutely secret. And of course, the big question is, how come? And I think we all know the answer to that. They've gone over to the dark side.
Tony appeared at the doorway.
What's up?
Michaels nodded at Jay and gave her a quick rundown.
Good work, Jay, she said. So what now?
Maybe somebody ought to take a trip to the ship and look around, Michaels said.
You going to ask the FBI to check it out?
Tony asked.
They don't have any jurisdiction there, Michaels said. And between you and me and the hidden microphone in my lamp, I don't trust the CIA as far as I can fly by waving my arms.
What are you saying here, Alex?
It's the dead of winter. A little trip to the Caribbean to gamble and take in the tropical sun would be a nice break, don't you think?
Me? Jay said. I'll do it.
Nope. Michaels looked at Tony. What do you think, Ms. Michaels? You up for a little work out of town?
The look in her face was priceless. After Jay was gone, Tony said,
You're serious?
Yes, ma'am. We need to send somebody there to get the lay of the place.
And you don't want to do it?
No, my wife would kill me if I went off like that, leaving her at home with a toddler.
Seriously, Alex, why me?
As I recall, the last time I tried to avoid sending you on an assignment because I was being overly protective, I got my ass handed to me. I learned my lesson.
Really?
Her voice was as dry as the Sahara.
Well, okay, I don't think it's going to be particularly dangerous, if you must know. You aren't going to have to do anything risky. Just walk around and get a feel for things. Get the routine down. I don't want you skulking into parts of the ship that are off limits to the public. No trying to swipe computer codes like that. I'll have Jay come up with some holographs of the programmers he's found.
You can study them, so if you happen to see one while you are there, fine. But the main thing is to gather information readily available.
Four?
I don't know exactly where this is going to lead. They are on the high seas and our laws don't apply. Sure, we could send a Navy destroyer or missile cruiser down to do a search, assuming we could convince the President to go for it. Not that likely a proposition. If we're wrong, every third world country on the planet would scream to high heaven about American imperialism and gunboat diplomacy. The drawback to being a superpower. If we can get enough stuff to be sure Cybernation is the guilty party, and that they are doing it from that ship, then we can maybe do something about it ourselves.
How do you mean?
John Howard's boys and girls are bored, so he tells me.
The director would kill you.
Not if we were right. It's within our charter. Sort of. We have as much right to be out on the oceans as anybody, right?
That's real iffy, Alex.
Not as bad as some we've done and gotten away with.
And you'd really be okay with me going?
As your husband and the father of your child, not so much. As your commander, I am more sanguine about it. You are a trained operative. You can take care of yourself, and the level of danger is very low.
And leave my husband with a toddler?
I have Guru to help, and you've been griping about being cooped up in the house or office, worried that you might turn into a woman who talks about baby poop at social gatherings. Go, take a couple of days, lose a few dollars of the government's money in the slot machines. Get some midwinter sun, properly sun-blocked, of course. She smiled.
Okay, I'll do it. Thanks, Alex.
We live to serve. Guess I'd better give John Howard a call.
You're sending him, too?
No, but he might want to start thinking about ways to sneak onto a ship in the middle of the ocean. On the Bon Chance. In the lowest hold behind locked and guarded doors were the EMP bombs. Santos knew vaguely how they worked, these devices, but they were not his thing. He had made the mistake of asking. The explosives expert practically peed himself as he talked happily about overlapping radiation pattern lobes and capacitors, coaxial this and coaxial that, of hardened components and planes of radiation. Santos listened with half an ear, nodded and murmured from time to time.
A bomb that didn't blow things up? How odd.
Well, yes, it did explode and destroy itself, but its primary purpose was to fry sensitive components with a powerful electromagnetic pulse generated by the explosion. Very complicated. Like a biological weapon that killed people but left the building standing, an EMP bomb was designed to kill computers but allow the people to remain. A bloodless weapon. The bomb man started off on some new techno rant, but Santos waved him quiet.
Yes, I understand, he said, lying through his smile. I need merely to be certain you understand where and when they must be delivered.
Oh, yes, I know.
Good. Attend to that. I will check back with you as we go.
Santos strode away, his footsteps upon the steel grating echoing slightly in the warm, dank hold. You'd think it would be cooler down here, right next to the water and all, but it wasn't. Timing on all this would be critical. They had only a week, and everything must be in place and synchronized exactly by then. It was not much time when you had to deploy men, transfer bombs, and make certain you knew exactly where and how to strike each target. Crawfish Point, Galveston, Texas, October 1957. It was raining, hard. There was a tropical storm offshore, close enough to bring lots of rain and choppy seas in the Gulf. Yet there Gridley came, in an old-fashioned wooden shrimping boat, arrogant as always, secure in the knowledge that he was invincible. Keller, wearing a black slicker and hiding in a mangrove tangled at the edge of the estuary with a Scope 30-36 Winchester deer rifle, watched Gridley maneuver the boat through the shallow water as he headed for the Gulf, checking for roots or half-submerged logs he might hit with the boat's propeller.
Once again, the scenario was over the top, much more than necessary to troll for the kind of information Jay wanted. The man never let one simple vision serve when he could do 9 visions complicated. And even the public scenarios he chose were major sensory sims, like that stupid climb up Mount Fuji. Please. Keller grinned at the memory. That had shaken old Jay up some, when he'd gone over in persona and sat down right next to him. Old Jay hadn't expected that. When the boat got within range, Keller laid the rifle's forestock on a gnarl of root and aimed. The rain slashed down hard, the wind blew, and the scope was wet and blurry. It wasn't an easy shot. He managed to put the first round into the wheelhouse side window, shattering it, but missing Jay by a good foot. He worked the bolt and fired again, aiming at the hull just below the normal waterline when the boat came up on a wave. He ejected the empty shell and chambered a third round, which he fired at the life preserver hung next to the wheelhouse. The boat chugged on, no sign of Jay, who must be ducked down inside the wheelhouse, wondering what the hell was going on. Enough. He had other business to which he needed to attend. This was fun, pulling Gridley's chain, but Omega was coming, and they had less than a week to get ready. He was going to have to let this go. In this scenario, which was Jay's, Keller had a small boat hidden behind the mangrove island in the swamp flats. Keller dropped the rifle, for which he had no further use, and worked his way to his boat. He started to untie the line that kept the craft from drifting away. When he did, a monstrous figure rose from the water like the creature from the Black Lagoon. Keller froze. The monster said, "Surprise!" And Keller realized it was a man in scuba gear and a wetsuit. Behind the face mask, he recognized Gridley's basic persona, which looked pretty much like the real man. Gridley had a big knife in his hand. He smiled and Keller bailed. Cybernation Train, Baden-Baden, Germany. Keller came out of the scenario cursing. Damn it, he had underestimated Gridley again. Overconfidence had been the downfall of a whole lot of programmers, and he had seen it happen enough to know nobody was immune, even him. Gridley might have opted for the status quo, turned into a fedhead, but he still had some moves. Keller was better than they'd been in college, but it wasn't smart to think that the old tie had stayed where he'd been. He might not be as good as Keller was, but he wasn't a total lubefoot either. It was too bad he didn't have time to call Jay out for a full wrangle, to show Jay who was better now. Well, there was no help for it, and no real harm done. Keller's net persona was a mule, a Joe average construct that didn't look like anybody in particular, certainly not his real self. Even if Gridley had seen him, he hadn't seen anybody he could put a face to. And even if he had known who it was, well, so what? Knowing who and figuring out where he was and doing anything about it before Omega launched wasn't going to happen. The train was moving and was now only a couple hundred kilometers northeast of Dijon, France. It would arrive at the border shortly, where it would turn around and head back toward Berlin. The powers that were in Cybernation did not want their 3 mobile centers anywhere near their headquarters in Geneva. The ship was in the Caribbean. The train went back and forth between Berlin and the French border, mostly half-loaded with tourists who knew nothing of the high-tech gear on board the other half. The third station was on a barge ostensibly being rebuilt at a shipyard in Yokohama, Japan, though it could be hauled off at any time. If the German authorities being paid to ignore the train developed pangs of conscience, or if the Japanese harbor officials who were bribed not to worry themselves over much about the repairs on the barge suddenly went mad, the ship was the safety, the most secure backup. If something happened to the train or the barge, or both, the ship would be the base nobody could legally touch. But any one of them was enough by itself to get the job done. All 3 were similarly equipped, and what one did was quickly uploaded to the others, so that any given moment, the lead team was never more than a few hours ahead of the others.
Major data transfers were done 4 times a day in all directions, so there wouldn't be more than 6 joint hours of work lost to the remaining 2 centers. It was a good system, not Keller's design, but good nonetheless. Washington, D.C. The Zoo. Jay and Saji walked along, looking at the tiger cage. It was cold enough so the big cats were inside their heated enclosure. For a long time after he had been mauled in VR by such a creature, it had been all Jay could do to look at the tigers. Now he made a point to stop by the zoo every so often to remind himself. He was only paying half his attention to the walk, though, and of course Saji noticed.
Where are you? Not here.
Sorry. I was thinking about the fishing boat scenario. I think I know who the shooter was.
Really? How so?
Well, when I ran the lists of the best computer programmers graduated in the last 10 years, I came up with quite a few I knew. Me, for one. A lot of guys I went to school with at CIT. So I tried to run down some of the guys I used to pal around with that I haven't seen in years.
Yes, and?
A couple have died. Most of the rest of them went into the field and have done pretty well. A few .biz millionaires. A couple dropped out completely to raise organic carrots or whatever.
Yes, and?
2 are missing. No record of them. Didn't die, just dropped off the face of the earth. One of them was a weirdo we all expected would go ballistic one day and assassinate somebody. The other was one of my best friends, a guy named Jackson Keller. We exchanged a couple of Christmas cards after school and then lost track of each other.
I see.
The thing is, I can't imagine he would drop out of the biz. He was gung-ho, like most of us. But there's no sign of him anywhere from about 3 years after we graduated.
So you think maybe this weirdo is somehow part of things?
He shook his head.
No, I think it's the other one, my old buddy Keller.
What makes you think that?
A couple of things. The weirdo, his name was Zimmerman, never had the chops to make me look bad in VR. Keller wasn't quite as good as I was, but he could have gotten better. And I've been thinking about that climb up Fujiyama. When the old Thai guy came and sat next to me, that's what Keller used to call me back in college. Jay, the old Thai. He was a year or two younger than most of us, a child prodigy who finished high school at 15.
You think the VR construct was a hint?
I think so, yeah. And you know what it really feels like? It feels personal. Like this guy knows me, wants to screw me up. And his stuff is like the stuff Keller used to do. He was always big on ambushes. He used to say, if you're going to duel with somebody, shoot them in the back before they see you coming. It'll save you a lot of grief. Their fault if they weren't paying attention.
Huh.
That's the best you can do?
What do you want me to say? Yes, you must be right, you brilliant stud.
He grinned.
Well, that would be okay. I like the sound of that.
Washington, D.C. Michaels pointed the remote at the television in disgust and clicked the set off. Have you seen this? A 3-hanky commercial for an internet service. Tony came out of the bathroom with the electric toothbrush in her mouth.
What?
Michaels waved at the television. The CyberNation ad.
Which one? The old lady abandoned in the nursing home by her children, or the young guy talking to his wife's tombstone?
The high school graduation.
Oh, that one.
These guys put the phone and insurance companies into the minor leagues. Most manipulative thing I've ever seen.
Hey, wait until you see the 13-year-old girl orphan on the street and the cop who comes to help her. Equal parts of pathos and pedophilia.
He shook his head. Don't they have any shame?
Not if they sell the product.
He shook his head again.
So, have you thought any more about what we talked about, Guru?
You really want to do this?
She nodded.
Yes, she's as much my grandma as anybody.
Every day from the time I was 13 until I went off to college, I spent 2 hours with her. sometimes at her house, sometimes on the steps out front, and sometimes in the park. Rain or shine, whatever else was going on, she was there for me. She gave me a skill that's the core of who I am. Whatever else happened to me, I was always sure I could take care of myself if somebody wanted to put his hands on me, and I didn't want him to. It was the basis of making my way in the world. If all else failed, I could kick somebody's butt. I didn't have to be afraid. She's useful here. Little Alex loves her. I love her, and I owe her for so much. She's 85. She won't be around much longer.
He chuckled. She'll probably outlive us all. Okay, if you really want this, then, yeah. Okay, ask her.
You sure?
What I'm sure of is that I want you to be happy, whatever it is. If that means having a coffee-swilling, deadly old nanny living in the guest bedroom, what the hell? He didn't think he'd ever seen her smile any bigger. She hugged him, and once again he marveled at how good that made him feel, to make her smile.
What was it Jay's girl Saji had said recently? Making somebody smile lightens your karmic burden? Well, if that was the case, he intended to be karmically clear on Tony's grins alone, if he could.
Cybernation Train, Kassel, Germany. The train was stopped, some kind of mechanical problem just outside Kassel. Some of the team had taken the opportunity to get off and stretch their legs, but Keller saw no reason to do so. He had never been a fan of outside. When you could go anywhere in time or space in VR, could control the weather, the smells, the action, why would you bother tromping around in the cold and dark next to a train track in the middle of nowhere, where you had no control at all, save that of your own body's ability to come or go? That's what the Luddites didn't understand, that virtual reality was so much better than the real world because you could make it do exactly what you wanted it to do. No wild cards. No chance that you would be caught in an unexpected snowstorm or bitten by a mosquito chock full of malaria. In VR, life was what you wanted it to be. This was the real reason that Cybernation would succeed more than anything. He went to the toilet, which on this old-style car was a pretty big place. 5 stalls, 5 urinals, a tile floor, mirrors, sinks, the whole enchilada. He stood in front of the urinal for what seemed like a long time, emptying his bladder, zipped up, and started to wash his hands.
"Hello, Jackson."
Keller froze. Smiling behind him, reflected in the mirror, was Roberto Santos. Keller forgot how to breathe.
"Roberto, what are you doing here? Something wrong?"
Santos moved to the door, locked it. Keller's mouth went dry.
"Nothing wrong, Jackson. Just balancing things out."
What?
"You touched my woman. You knew she was mine, and you went with her. I know it was her idea. I know how she is. I know turning her down is not easy. But she was mine. She still is, until I say otherwise."
Listen, Santos, it was a mistake. A mistake. I'm sorry. I really am. I'm sorry. What can I do to make it up to you?
Santos smiled.
"Don't worry so much, Jackson. I'm not gonna kill you. It won't even show. But you got a debt. It has to be paid."
Santos, don't. You don't want to do this. Jasmine will fire you.
"No, she won't. Because you won't tell her."
"I will. I will."
"No, you won't. And you know why? Because if she fires me, I will come back and kill you. But only after a long, long time of you wishing you were dead. You understand?"
Keller's fear gripped him so hard he started to shake. Santos moved so fast and hit him just under the sternum. He couldn't get any air. Santos smiled, a man enjoying himself. As Keller tried to get his wind back, Santos hit him again.
The rental car was cold when Santos started it, and it took the heater a while to warm things up. He hated the cold. Yes, they had winter at home, but it was the kind of winter where you could walk around in a t-shirt and shorts. In Rio, the temperature was almost always perfect. It was God's country, and men who lived there were fortunate above other men. The plane he was going to catch was at a private airport, about 30 miles away. From there, he would fly to a big airport in Berlin, and from there, back to the U.S. He was supposedly making sure that preparations for the big attack were in order, and in a way he was. He had already talked to the people he needed to talk to, and he would see others. Putting fear into Keller was part of the preparations as far as he was concerned. He smiled at the memory of Keller, lying curled like a newborn on the floor in the train's washroom, a pool of yellow vomit next to him. He hadn't really hurt the man, nothing permanent, never hit him in the face. He would be sore tomorrow, belly, ribs, back, thighs, and he would bruise some, but nothing that would show when he was dressed. It hadn't been particularly satisfying to beat him, like slapping a child. He had offered no resistance, but it had to be that way. There were things that a man had to do if he was going to remain a man and not turn into an old woman. He hadn't decided yet how he was going to punish Missy, but he was smart enough to know he needed to wait until the attack was finished. There would be a bonus for successful completion, a big bonus, enough so he could walk away if he really wanted to do that. Keller would say nothing to Missy. If he knew anything, Santos knew when a man would stand and fight, and Keller was not such a man. Missy was more dangerous. She could put a knife between your ribs if you pissed her off bad enough. He would punish her. He had to. But it must be in such a way that she could not revenge herself upon him. He might even have to kill her. Washington, D.C. The lobbyist's name was Corina Skye. She was a drop-dead gorgeous natural blonde who looked 5 years younger than her 35 years. She had graduated first in her class at Columbia in political science and was considered the best lobbyist on internet issues in the country. Chant sat across the table from Skye in the booth at Umberto's. With Wayne DeWitt's unfortunate accident, a terrible tragedy, things will be easier on the senatorial side, Skye said. She didn't know that DeWitt's injuries had been on Chance's orders. She wasn't in that loop. We've gone to a full press in the House. Congressman Kinsey Walker, he's a D from California, will offer his bill on Monday. We have the votes to get it out of committee, though we're still 8 shy for passage in the House, but we'll get those. The waiter came by. Would the ladies care for dessert and coffee? Just coffee, they both said. You do realize that this bill is not what we'd hoped for, Skye said. It's only about half strength. Chance nodded. Yes, but it's a start. Once this is established, then it's like new taxes. It won't go away, and we can strengthen it next session. The first part of making an omelet is to collect some eggs. Both of them smiled, women of the world. I've seen the latest TV spots, Skye said. What do you think? Skye chuckled. The people who make Kleenex must love you. Subscriptions are up 12% since we started running the new series. Skye wiped a bit of lipstick from her coffee cup with a napkin. Doesn't surprise me. I'd expect them to be effective. Subtle doesn't work for television viewers. Lowest common denominator and all. They both laughed. Tony was excited. It had been some time since she had been in the field, back when she and Alex had had their troubles on that trip to England more than a year ago. She smiled at the memory, which was bittersweet, such heartache they'd gone through. She had packed for warm weather, one bag she could fit into the overhead bin on the jet. Documents had provided her with a new ID. She was Mary Johnson, a divorce secretary from Falls Church, Virginia. She was on holiday going to play the slot machines and soak up the sunshine. You still packing, girl? Guru came into the bedroom, little Alex slung over her right hip.
Guru, I don't know how you expect him to practice walking if you never put him down.
Guru smiled and bounced the baby on her hip a couple of times. He laughed.
Don't you worry about him learning to walk. Pretty soon, I start teaching him jurus. Time you get back, he'll be a fighter.
I'm only going to be gone 3 days.
Plenty of time, eh, best boy?
Little Alex laughed again. Washington, D.C. Michaels was propped up in bed watching the news when the comm chimed. He reached for it, thinking it was Tony.
Hey, boss!
The visual blossomed on the receiver, a tiny hologram of a face that definitely wasn't Tony's.
Jay, what's up?
I've got good news, better news, and not so good news.
Oh, give me the good news first.
I found Jackson Keller.
I didn't know he was lost. Who is Jackson Keller?
Long story. Short version, I believe he's the guy running the WebNet attacks.
Good. Where can we collect him?
Well, see, that's the not-so-good stuff. I'm not exactly sure where he is. I know where he was up until a few days ago, I think, but I'm pretty sure I know who he's working for.
And that would be?
The better news. Cybernation.
You're sure about this?
Yep. Want me to dazzle you with my brilliance?
Do I have a choice?
Jay ignored that.
I scanned public tax records in the U.S. and found he had paid federal taxes last year on foreign income grosses of $250,000. I checked in corporation records and found a Delaware company called Molotov Software Programs, Inc., the president being one Jackson Keller. Apparently, the vice president is his mother, the secretary treasurer his uncle. That's got tax dodger scam written all over it. From what I was able to determine, all of MSP's income for the last 3 years came from another corporation, Systems Upgrade, Inc., which turns out to be a shell owned by Future Tense Computer Engineering, which is, when you run it down, another shell owned, lock, stock, and barrel by, ta-da, Cybernation. Corporate credit cards, Visa, MasterCard, American Express, have been issued for MSP, Inc. from the International Bank of Zurich, and 3Cs and TRW both say that the credit is good, which means he pays his bills on time. Without a warrant, I can't get into real specific details on those transactions, but I've checked commercial usage location lists and gotten hits in Southeast Florida for the last 3 months. Before that, he spent some time in Japan, and before that, in Germany. Apparently, Cybernation owns some rolling stock and some other ships. The train carries tourists back and forth between Berlin and France, and there is some kind of repair work being done on the boat, or barge, or whatever, in Yokohama.
He does some traveling, Michael said.
Yeah, but the South Florida thing is the deal. He goes to the same place as the other programmers on the gambling boat go. Last hit was less than 10 days ago, so my guess is he's on the boat. I don't know what his connection to the Cybernation stuff in Germany and Japan is, but I'm gonna find out.
You think this is the leader of the assault team?
I bet money on it, boss. He's a programmer out of CIT, second in his class.
Isn't that where you went to school?
Yeah.
Michaels heard something in Jay's voice.
What?
I know the guy. I used to know him anyway.
Second in his class, you said? He must be pretty sharp.
Not as sharp as the guy who was first in the class.
Ah.
I'm gonna dig some more. When I think I got enough for a warrant, I'll shoot it past Hang'em High Harvey, and then we can pin this moth to the collecting board.
Good work, Jay.
Thanks, boss. Discom.
After he broke the connection, the comm chimed again. This time it was Tony. She looked tired, but she was smiling.
Hey, babe, he said.
Hi, I'm settled in. I'm at the Airport Hilton in Fort Lauderdale. I'll catch you a shuttlecopter to the ship in the morning.
You're calling from the hotel?
It had been a while since she'd been in the field, but surely she hadn't forgotten something so basic.
Not on the house phone. I'm using the coded cell.
He nodded. NetForce had field phones that looked ordinary, but sent and received shifting code encrypted messages. Even if somebody managed to trap the signal, they wouldn't be able to translate it into anything they could understand unless they had a matching transceiver. Michael's housecom was so equipped, just as all the Virgils were. SOP.
How's the boy?
He's fine. Conked out about 8. Guru has him in bed with her. She's gonna spoil him.
How are you doing?
Cold and pitiful in this big old bed all alone.
Poor baby. I'll be all alone in this big hotel bed, too.
You'd better be. That got him a smile. I just got a call from Jay. He explained what Jay had just told him.
Does he have a picture of this guy? Maybe I'll spot him on the ship.
I'll have him upload one to your flat screen if he has one. I'll have him bury it in a picture of your Aunt Molly's 70th birthday or something.
Thanks. Thank you for sending me to do this. I appreciate it.
No problem. Just don't do anything other than what is in your mission plan.
By the numbers, Commander, honey. Don't worry.
But of course, he did.
Woodville, Mississippi. This was not a town where you would expect to find a major internet locus, Santos thought. Probably why it was here, not far from the Louisiana border, in the southwest corner of Mississippi. Woodville was a sleepy place that time seemed to have touched only lightly in passing in its last few decades. Santos drove the old pickup truck along the lower Woodville Road carefully. This was just a scouting trip to be certain of the information he had been provided. He was a black man in a small southern town, and while racial profiling was not supposed to be allowed by police departments in this country anymore, he knew they still did it in such places. A shiny new rental car would have made him suspect. A beat-up 10-year-old truck with local plates made him less likely to be noted. He would only get 2 passes by the location. One going out, another half an hour later coming back. Any more than that might raise suspicion, and he did not want that. A few minutes later, he saw the driveway leading off to the west. There weren't any signs, but 100 feet off the road was an 8-foot-high chain-link gate and a wooden kiosk behind it. He couldn't see the guard in the little building, but surely there must be one. That would be the place. What else could they have worth guarding out here? Some of the targets would be blown up electronically. Some would be taken out with more conventional explosives. And some would be captured and utilized for Cybernation's own ends, at least for a short while. This location needed to be functional for a critical few hours after the shit hit the fan, and he was going to see that it happened that way. At first, he hadn't really understood how this was supposed to be good for business. Missy had explained. When a citizen's water or power shuts off, he doesn't care why. The only question that matters to him is, when will it be back on? If somebody's internet service dies and they need it or want it badly enough, and there's somebody standing right there with a shiny wire that will reconnect things just like that, a lot of customers will switch, no questions asked, except maybe how much and how soon. And the answers will be, less than you were paying before, and immediately. These were the answers they wanted to hear. With a surge of added customers clamoring to join up, Cybernation's political base would instantly grow stronger. Authorities would, of course, worry and wonder who was responsible, and they would certainly suspect Cybernation, who would benefit from such chaos. But they would have no proof, and the man in his little house in Nowhere, Indiana, that wasn't his problem. All he wanted to do was collect his email or download his pornographic pictures. It was simple human nature. In the right place, at the right time, a bottle of water would be worth a fortune. Timing was critical. Santos could see it when she explained it that way. People here must be very stupid. But then again, people everywhere were mostly stupid. Berlin, Germany. When the pain got to be too much, and it was actually worse the second day, Keller got off the train when it stopped and went to a doc-in-the-box in Dellendorf to get some medicine for it. The dock in the box was part of a chain that stretched across Europe, centered in the UK. They didn't ask questions, and if you didn't want to show them an insurance card, they didn't care as long as your cash or credit was good. The doctor, a gray-haired and gray-bearded old man named Koenig, who prodded and poked a little, said in fairly good English,
"So you fell down a flight of stairs, is that right?"
"Yeah."
The old man smiled.
"What?"
"I've been a doctor 46 years, my friend. In a land where narrow and deep old stairs are common, if you fell down a riser, it was after somebody beat you."
You can tell that by looking? How?
"Look here."
He made a fist and touched it lightly to a brownish-yellow splotch on Keller's chest. "Even if you hit the edge of a step, it leaves a line, not a shape that matches perfectly a human fist like this does. Somebody punched and kicked you."
"Over a woman, was it?"
Keller started to deny it, then shrugged. Who cared if this old man knew? He would never see him again.
"Yes."
"Beautiful?"
"Yes."
"Ach, that is the problem with the beautiful ones, mein Freund. I see nothing broken. Here is a prescription. You can fill it at the apotheca out front when you leave, if you wish. It is a generic version of Vicodin. Do not drink alcohol or take sleeping pills, Vissies. Be careful if you drive. It can make you drowsy or slow your reactions. You should be feeling much better in a few days."
"Thank you."
The doctor waved him off. Keller gave the prescription to a woman in the built-in drugstore on the way out. But when he went to pay for it in the office visit, he didn't have enough cash in Deutschmarks. He shrugged and handed her his Visa card. While she was scanning the card, he unscrewed the cap and dry-swallowed two of the pills. By the time the cab got back to the train, he was feeling pretty good. Hardly hurt at all. Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Tony leaned back in the seat and watched the dust boil up under them as the big transport helicopter lifted from the pad. The craft, a Sikorsky S-92, held 18 passengers and was full. Most of them actually were, she assumed, what she was supposed to be. Tourists going to the gambling ship, which, as the flight attendant had announced, was 90 miles offshore. According to the schedule in the hotel, they scheduled these flights on the half hour, starting at 6 a.m., with the last one returning from the ship to the mainland at midnight, 37 flights a day, which meant at capacity, they could move over 650 people a day to and from the ship from this one heliport. And there were at least three other ports in operation just on the Florida coast, not counting those in Cuba or the other islands. She looked over the passengers without staring at anyone in particular. About what she'd expect, there were several couples, sporting fresh sunburns and wearing shorts and colorful Hawaiian shirts, likely going to see if they might be able to win back some of their children's college tuition. There were a few women who appeared to be traveling alone, most of them also middle-aged. A couple of men looked like she'd always pictured high rollers, dressed in Western chic with ostrich-skin cowboy boots and Stetson hats. There was a very fit-looking, shaved, bald black man of 30 or so in a yellow silk T-shirt and khaki trousers with dark sunglasses, who leaned back in his seat and appeared to be sleeping. He wore a gold Oyster Rolex on his left wrist, a gold nugget pinky ring, and a matching bracelet of heavy gold links on his right wrist. From the way he sat and the look of his musculature under the thin silk, Tony's first impression was that he was a cop or some kind of security officer. He might be asleep, but he looked as if he could go from 0 to 60 in a heartbeat. Not that exciting a group, and nobody who looked like what she thought an international computer terrorist ought to look like.
"Well, what did you expect? Geeky-looking guys with pocket protectors and horn-rimmed glasses, their fingers glued to palm pilots or flat screens?"
She grinned at herself. Computer wizards came in all sizes and shapes, and it was a fallacy to think they all looked like classic movie nerds. She of all people ought to know that. Here she was pretending to be a tourist when she was, in fact, a spy. Well. She'd be at the ship in a few minutes. She'd get checked in, find her cabin, then take her camera and wander around, snapping perfectly innocent pictures of whatever was open to public view. She had the picture Jay had sent late last night. She'd strained it from the covering JPEG of her mythical aunt. It was a college yearbook image of this guy Keller, and Jay had added 10 years to it with a plastic surgery art program. She had memorized the picture, then wiped it from the flat screen's drive, overwriting the file so it couldn't be recovered. As the commuter helicopter approached the gambling ship, she saw that the actual landing site was a huge flat-top barge anchored a few hundred yards away, with several long passenger boats shuttling people back and forth from it to the floating casino. She counted 6 helipads on the barge. That made sense. All those copters taking off and landing on the ship itself would be a windy, noisy commotion, better left elsewhere. Smart. On the Bond Chance. Santos watched the dark-haired woman walk away from the shuttle boat toward the cabin check-in queue and nodded to himself. She moved well, inside her balance, something most people did not do. Something in her stance, her carriage, indicated some kind of physical training. A dancer, maybe, or a gymnast. She was alone, wore no rings, a tourist from the States. Were he not so busy with all the things he needed to do right now, she would be a pleasure he would like to try. Missy would love that, wouldn't she? To see him with another woman? She was so sure of herself in that way, she would not believe a man could prefer somebody else to her. Maybe he was not as busy as he thought. When you could kill 2 birds in 1 stone, was that not a rock worth throwing? He grinned at the thought. Missy would steam like turtle soup.
Hello, Berto.
Speak of the devil.
Without further planning, Santos allowed his gaze to linger on the woman from the helicopter as she walked toward the registration area. Missy could not help but notice he was looking at something other than her. He caught the flash of anger as it lit her face. It was there only for a moment before she hid it, but it was there. Ah, good. Already he felt a warm satisfaction.
Your trip was successful?
My trips are always successful.
Made some new friends, did you?
He shrugged, slow and lazy, gave her a small lopsided grin. Her smile grew chilly.
We have a lot of things to discuss. Why don't you meet me in my office in an hour?
With that, she turned and walked away. Now, of course, he more or less had to follow up on the attractive brunette with the dancer's stroll. He would talk to the clerk at the room check-in and ask about her, find out who she was, which cabin she was in. It was a big ship, but not so large as all that. He could find a way to run into the woman on deck or in the casino, maybe even the gym, since it was obvious she worked out. A chance meeting, a little conversation, perhaps a drink. And they would go on from there. A man had to do what he had to do, but he had to admit, some jobs were more fun than others.
Zehlendorf Forest, Berlin, Germany, summer, 1959. Jay was in a tracking mode, a skill Saji had taught him when he'd been recovering from his stroke. He walked carefully along the dirt road, cutting sign, looking for the smallest indication that his quarry had come this way. The road was easy. It was dusty, and upon it, the passages of somebody in a vehicle or on foot were simple to spot. No problem. Somebody looking to hide his trail could brush the tracks away. That might seem smart, but really wasn't if you knew anything about how to follow a trail. Sometimes, as Sherlock Holmes was wont to say, it was the absence of the dog barking in the night that was important. The lack of impressions on a dirt road were more telling than any boot print. Carpet walkers would sometimes glue carpet to the bottoms of their shoes so as not to leave impressions, but that worked on sand or rocky soil, not on a red dirt road with baby powder fine dust. Instead, it would leave distinct patches of relatively smooth tracks. No, a smart runner would get off the road entirely. But if somebody was taking only the barest precautions and they didn't really think they were going to be noticed or tailed, they weren't likely to be as cautious. Keller wore carpet shoes, and for most people, most of the time, his basic moves would have done the job. Anybody walking but not looking wouldn't notice the smooth patches. Even somebody looking for tracks of a particular kind of shoe would probably miss them. But Smokin' Jay Gridley wasn't just anybody, was he? It was a nice day for a walk. Greenery everywhere, flowers in bloom, the smell of pollen and dust in the summery early evening air. Ahead on the right was a weathered wooden building. It had a caduceus painted on the side, the winged staff with two snakes twined around it, indicating a doctor's office. Yes, this must be the place. Jay walked to the front door. The office was closed for the day and the door was locked, but the latch was an old-style spring lock, and it took all of 10 seconds for Jay to open it with a skeleton key he pulled from his pocket. It was dark and quiet inside. Jay flipped a light switch up. There was a 4-drawer steel file cabinet full of patients' files next to a big wooden desk. The drawers were locked, but he opened them with a couple of bent paper clips. So easy when you knew how. He found the file quickly enough, too. Keller hadn't even bothered to use a phony name and had paid for the office visit and medication with his corporate credit card, which is how Jay had tracked him here so quickly. He read the report. "Fell downstairs," was what had been written on the new patient form. The physical examination showed multiple contusions and abrasions. In one corner, in tiny, neat lettering, was a note. "Altercation C, jealous boyfriend over woman," it said. The letter C had a line over it, and the words were underlined twice. So, what do you know? Keller had gotten his butt kicked for fooling around with somebody else's girlfriend. That was interesting. Keller had never been a ladies' man in school, but you never could tell. Jay himself hadn't been that much of a lover boy back then either. Things changed. He put the report back into the drawer, closed and relocked it, looked out the window to make sure nobody was around, then exited the building, locking it behind him. Technically, he was bending the law here. While he had a legal warrant to do an electronic search, that permission only extended to the U.S. borders. While NetForce did have reciprocity agreements with dozens of countries, including Germany, and the U.S. federal warrant could eventually have gotten a counterpart here, he didn't have time to wait. He wasn't planning to use this information in court, so it didn't have to have all the I's dotted and the T's crossed. Outside, behind the doctor's office, was a small hill. Jay climbed to the top and looked around. Kruma Lake was to the west, a short distance away, on the edge of the Berlin Forest. The Grunewald area was right over there. There were roads, a train track, and what was still West Berlin, deep in the eastern heart of a divided Germany. That wouldn't be reunited for decades. The Cold War was still cranking up in this era. So Keller was in Germany, or at least he had been yesterday. Why Germany? Who was the jealous boyfriend who must live here who clobbered Keller? Where had he gone? That was the problem with searching for information. Sometimes you came up with more questions than answers. Hold on a second. Wasn't there something else about Germany he had come across recently? Something about a barge? No, that was Japan. It was a train. Cybernation ran a tourist train or some such here, and there were the Iron Horses tracks right there. Maybe it was a sign. Maybe not. But it gave him something he could check. Train schedules were public information. Find all those that had passed on this track down there for the last couple of days. Find out if the one owned by Cybernation was around. If it was, that would certainly be a big coincidence, wouldn't it? On the Bon Chance. Tony played the tourist, mindful of what she had come to the ship to do. She carried a cheap electronic camera, and she took pictures of her room, the exterior decks, the swimming pool, and the helicopter barge. She played the slot machines. Late in the afternoon, she went back to her cabin and changed into workout clothes, bike shorts and a halter top, running shoes, white cotton socks. She didn't want to practice Sealot while she was here, even in her room, but she could at least ride the stationary bike. She draped a towel around her shoulders, tucked her room keycard into her left sock top, and headed for the gym. There were a dozen people in the gym, which was down a level from her cabin. The place had 8 or 10 weight station machines, pneumatic rather than stacks of iron, 6 bikes, 3 stair climbers, 2 treadmills, and in one corner, a heavy punching bag. Tony wished she could work the bag, but she didn't want to draw any attention to herself. Even in this day and age, a little woman beating the stuffing out of a punching bag drew raised eyebrows and male interest. Tony got a free bottle of spring water from the dispenser, did a little stretching and a few warm-ups, then moved to one of the cardio bikes. She was halfway through what she figured would be a 40-minute ride when the black man she'd seen on the copter ride out came in. He wore an old pair of baggy shorts, no shirt, rubber sandals, a white cotton headband, and had a towel around his neck. The shorts had the Bon Chance logo on them. He must work here, she realized. If he was a tourist, the shorts would be new, not old and worn as they were, right? He moved to the hanging bag, kicked off his sandals, tossed the towel next to them, and went through a series of stretches. The man stood in front of the bag and started slapping it, open-handed, first with the palms, then with the backs of his hands. He developed a rhythm. Palm right, backhand right, palm left, backhand left, until the sound of the strike sounded like somebody working a speed bag. Wapada, 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 wapada. After a couple of minutes, he switched to elbows, and then he switched from elbows to punches using hammer fists. The timer on Tony's bike cheeped. She looked down at it. The black man had been working the bag for 20 minutes, and while he was sweating profusely, he didn't look particularly tired. This guy was in incredible shape, and though she couldn't tell from the strikes what his art was, he was obviously deep in some fighting discipline. He moved in balance the whole time. Interesting. She warmed down on the bike for another minute, gradually slowing her pedaling. She stepped off the bike, wiping her face with the towel, finished off her water, then started for the exit. The black man stepped back, reached for his towel, wiped his face and head, slipped his feet into his sandals, and walked away. He was a few feet behind Tony when she stepped into the hall.
"You a dancer?"
Tony looked at the man. Was he hitting on her? In her guise of divorced secretary, she would probably be receptive to such things. He was a strong, good-looking man. Then again, she was supposedly from the South and might have a racial prejudice. So perhaps she ought to seem a little timid. If he worked here, maybe she could find out some things from him.
No, not really.
You have the legs.
Tony gave him what she thought would pass for an embarrassed smile.
Well, I try to keep in shape. Are you a boxer?
He shrugged.
Kind of.
He moved up next to her as they walked.
Your first visit to the ship?
Yes. You've been here before?
Oh, yes. I work here.
Really? What do you do?
I'm with security.
Tony raised her eyebrows.
How exciting.
He shrugged again.
Pretty dull, mostly. You maybe want to get a drink later?
Tony pretended to be more nervous than she felt.
Well, maybe.
He grinned.
I don't bite, Missy. My name is Roberto Santos.
He put out his hand.
I'm Mary Johnson.
She took his hand, and she could feel the power in his grip, even though he throttled it way back.
From Falls Church, Virginia?
It is my pleasure to meet you.
He released her hand.
That drink?
Oh, okay. I want to shower and change. Can I meet you somewhere?
How about the Lady Luck? That's the little bar next to the dining room outside the main casino. In an hour.
That would be fine.
After he had gone on his way, Tony felt her heartbeat start slow. It had been a long time since she had been in the field working a contact. This man was dangerous.
No question of that. On the Cybernation train, near Halberstadt, Germany. When Jay sneaked onto the train, he kept it simple. This close to Keller, he wanted to be sure he wasn't distracted by historical details or esoteric odors in a complex scenario. Keller was, he had shown, too good to shrug off. So the train was just a train. The era was the present and real time, and Jay's plan was to get in and out without raising a ruckus. He hadn't come to slap Keller's face with a glove and challenge him to a duel, only to find out whether he was here or not. The duel would come later, on Jay's terms. Not that even this much was easy. He made his way through the baggage car with his utmost stealth. Cracking any of Cybernation's secure services would be extremely difficult. These were people who prided themselves on their ability to program and weave, and any chinks in their armor would be microscopically small. But the train ran on public tracks, and it had a connection to the railway system's computers, which were a lot easier to rascal. Jay wasn't hurting anything. He wasn't going to even peek at the rail system's files. He was just riding their coded SIG into the Cybernation train. Jay got through the baggage car. Just ahead was the conductor's office. Jay knocked, and when nobody answered, he slipped the lock with a credit card and stepped inside. If the conductor had been in his office, Jay would have offered some excuse, gone away, and created a diversion that would have drawn the man out. A file cabinet stood near the conductor's desk, but it was partially open, not even locked. Jeez Louise, not that the lock would have stopped him, but still, they didn't have to make it so easy. It was amazing to him how often people who should know better left their doors unlocked. A few minutes shuffling through papers came up with what he wanted, a passenger list. He looked at several other manifests, on the off chance somebody might someday notice he had poked around in here. No point in being obvious about what he was looking for. Jay recognized several of the names on the passenger list from his own list of high-end computer program grads, and there, plain as day, was the name he had come to find, Jackson Keller. So this was where he was, and this was where his primary team was, too. Jay put the list back into the drawer. He had what he wanted. Time to leave.
"We've got a hacker incursion," Taggart said.
Keller stared at her. "Incursion? Not a failed attempt? Impossible."
"Not in our systems. In the train's op comp."
"Let me see." He moved to the workstation where Samantha Taggart, the security monitor for this shift, sat.
"Nothing to see. He's come and gone."
"What did he do?"
"Nothing to speak of. He accessed several housekeeping files, didn't take anything, didn't leave a worm or virus behind. Probably some kid trying out a new cracker program."
"Which files?"
"Never mind."
Keller tapped in a key sequence. The file list appeared in a real-time crawl on the holoproj. Mail manifest, cargo bills of lading, passenger list, station stops. Who would bother? There was nothing there to see.
"You backwalled him?"
"Far as I could. It was an anonymous SIG from somewhere in the No Atlantic net. It frayed 800 ways from Sunday past that."
"That would be pretty sharp for a kid hacker."
"I used to do it when I was a kid." "You used to do it. It's not that hard."
Keller chewed his lip. Nothing was taken. Nothing there to take, really. Who could possibly care where the train stopped, what it carried for cargo or mail, or who was on it? He blinked. He opened the passenger file. There they were, his team, himself, the train crew. He felt a sudden cold rush in his lower belly. Gridley. He shook his head.
"Can't be. He doesn't even know who we are."
"Excuse me?"
He looked at Taggart.
Nothing. Never mind. You're right. It was probably some kid screwing around. No harm, no foul."
But as he walked away, Keller's fluttering bowels didn't settle down. If it wasn't some kid trying to break into a system just for the hell of it, then who could it be? And the only answer was somebody who wanted to know who was on the train. Maybe Gridley had figured it out. Maybe that old Thai persona Keller had used had been too good a clue.
And if it was Gridley, and he knew Keller was on the train with his team, then they were in deep trouble. If the Americans thought this train had anything to do with the net and web disruptions, they would be all over the Germans to pull it to a stop and have a look-see. And if Gridley knew about this platform, maybe he knew about the barge in Yokohama, too. It wouldn't be safe there, either. He had to get off the train. Fast. NetForce HQ, Quantico, Virginia. Michaels looked at Jay, then at John Howard, the other man in his office.
It's iffy. Jay nodded.
Yep. I don't have ironclad proof, but I'm positive Keller is the guy leading the charge. He's got the chops, and CyberNation is the organization that stands to gain more than anybody. Last week, he and his team were on the boat, and now they are on a big old electric train in Deutschland. If we can grab them, I bet we can squeeze a confession out of one of them and sure stop anything they're planning.
There's due process for you, Michael said. What I want to know more about is this connection among the three locations, Howard said. The train, the barge in Japan, the ship.
Jay said, Triple redundancy. I think each of these has got identical computer systems set up. They share the information. If something happens to one, they still have two backups. That's how I'd do it.
So it wouldn't do us any good to take out the train by itself?
Well, General, it would tell us for sure if these guys are the villains if we got a look at their hardware and software. Don't we have any spies who can do a walkthrough in RT?
We've already got a spy on the boat, Michaels reminded him.
Yeah, but she's not supposed to poke around in the private decks. Besides, we know that Keller is on the train now, anyhow. I'm telling you, this is the real deal.
Michael shook his head. Even if I believed you, and it happens I do, we don't have enough to start arresting people. And if we could shut down the train and the barge at... Where was it? The shipworks. That would still leave the gambling ship down there in the Caribbean. If they are about to do something else nasty, wouldn't that be likely to precipitate it? Jay shrugged.
Maybe, but they might not be ready to go for it yet. Our defenses have gotten better. It'll be harder next time. Plus, if we get Keller and his big guns, that's gonna monkey wrench it. The second team won't be as good.
If that's all they do, Howard said. Michaels looked at him. Remember that cut transcontinental fiber optic cable where they found the two dead militiamen? Have we considered that they might be linked?
Michael shook his head.
Why would they do that? Well, sir, if it were me, I'd want a multi-pronged attack on something as big as the Internet. Sticking it with a knife in the hind leg will make it bleed, but that won't kill it, or even seriously slow it down. But if you shot it in the head, maybe set off a charge of dynamite under it at the same time.
The general has a point, boss. There is more than one way to shut off a node. Doesn't have to be with software. Could be with hardware. My programmers can't fix that.
Great. I need to hear this.
Alex leaned back in his chair and thought about it for a second.
All right. I'm going to present this to the director and get her thoughts about it. Meanwhile, General, you might want to fine-tune your shipboarding scenarios. I'm expecting an update from Tony soon. You can add that into your data files.
On the Bon Chance. The bar was relatively quiet, but the muted sound of bells going off in the casino filtered through the walls. Tony, dressed now in jeans, running shoes, and a dark blouse, arrived 10 minutes early and looked around. She noted the exits, then found a small table next to the wall in the corner. She sat with her back against the wall. A young and pretty waitress in a short black skirt and white shirt was at the table 15 seconds later.
Tony ordered, and it was only another minute or two before the waitress returned with a tall glass of tomato juice with a celery stick in it. Quick service. Roberto Santos arrived exactly on the hour. He wore a dark suit, Armani, if she was any judge, a black silk scoop-necked T-shirt, and alligator loafers.
Miss Johnson, good to see you again.
Mr. Santos.
Roberto, please. Mr. Santos is my father.
They exchanged smiles. The waitress was there before Santos settled fully in his chair, and she had a drink on her tray.
Thank you, Betty.
The waitress dimpled, then moved away. Santos sipped at the drink.
Ah, he said.
He looked at her and answered what he thought was her unasked question.
Coconut milk and Cuban rum. Very fattening. I have to work extra hard after I have one of these.
He raised his glass to her and she held up her tomato juice.
Two new friends.
Why not?
They clinked glasses. She nursed her juice while he finished his rum and coconut milk and started a second one. He was very smooth, this Santos. It didn't take a genius to realize he was hoping to get laid. Well, he was going to be disappointed. When she asked questions about his work, he managed to slip them, like a good boxer does punches. He walked around, he said. He watched for trouble. Tony smiled and pretended to be impressed anyhow. He wasn't telling the truth. If something was going on upon this ship, Santos here was part of it. She was sure of that. But short of blowing in his ear and going off to his cabin with him, how was she going to find out what he knew?
You have not had supper yet? He said, we should go and eat.
Tony realized that extracting herself from this would be more difficult if they had dinner, and she was about to offer an excuse when Santos glanced away from her at somebody who had just entered the bar. Tony looked at the entrance. There was a strikingly beautiful woman standing there. She looked Amerasian. She was tall, had black hair past her shoulders. She wore a red blouse tucked into a matching skirt that stopped 4 inches above her knees. The clothes were snug enough to reveal a svelte hourglass figure, but not so tight as to look trashy. Tony was aware that the conversational background noise suddenly dropped in volume. Virtually everybody in the place was looking at the new arrival, except Santos.
Who is that? She asked.
He looked at her.
Pardon?
In the red, over there.
He looked, pretending not to have seen the woman before.
Ah, that is Jasmine Chance.
His accent thickened a bit, so that his next sentence came out.
She work on the boat, too.
Not Hispanic, Tony decided. Brazilian, maybe. The woman, meanwhile, was on the move, and it looked to Tony as if she was heading right toward their table, smiling like the Cheshire Cat. Sure enough, she approached their table.
Roberto.
Hello, Missy,
he grinned back. While it was all pleasant and smiley on the surface, Tony immediately felt that charged atmosphere that couples who'd been arguing sometimes had just before they put on their public faces.
Aren't you going to introduce me to your friend, Roberto?
Santos held up a lazy hand.
This is Mary Johnson. She is an executive assistant from Falls Church, Virginia. Mary, this is Jasmine Chance, head of security, my boss.
A secretary,
Chance said, looking at Santos. Contempt practically dripped from her voice. Tony felt a strong urge to stand up and slap the woman for that patronizing tone, but that wouldn't be in character. Not at all. Chance never moved her penetrating gaze from Santos.
An important security matter came up. Perhaps your friend could excuse us for a moment.
Tony would have loved to stay and listen to this conversation, but it provided the easy exit she needed.
Oh, of course, I was just about to leave anyway. I'm feeling a bit under the weather.
No need to leave, Santos said. I'm sure this won't take long.
He wasn't looking at Tony either, but at Chance. Tony stood.
Nice to meet you, Ms. Chance. Thank you for the drink, Roberto. Maybe I'll see you again.
She hurried away, just in time.
She had to call Alex, and the window for the call was pretty narrow. Back in her cabin, she went into the small bathroom and started the shower. That her room might be bugged was unlikely, but it paid to be careful. Once the water was running, she used her disguised scrambler phone to call Alex. Vox only, no visual. Tony's call went through a military comstat she knew would be footprinting the area for the next 10 minutes.
Hey, babe, how's it going?
Fine. I haven't seen Jay's guy.
That's okay. We think he's in Germany. Anything else?
I've managed to meet a couple of people who look interesting. You might have Jay run their names and see what he can come up with.
Shoot.
She gave him Santos and Chance. Describe them.
I'll pass it on to Jay. How are you doing?
I'm okay. I miss you and little Alex.
We miss you, too. He's fine. Guru is fine. I'm fine. Nothing to worry about here. Listen, I need you to plug whatever you've got, pics, thoughts, diagrams, into a file and upload it to one of the secure mailboxes. Mark it for John's attention.
I won't be able to do it until next Comstat pass, unless you want to risk using the ship's transmitter.
No, it'll wait a couple hours.
What's up? He explained Jay's theory about Cybernation's train and barge. He finished by saying,
I spoke to the director. Ordinarily, the government would be hesitant to move with so little hard evidence, but the powers that be are really nervous about this situation. There are going to be some strings pulled. The German train and the Japanese barge are going to get unexpected visitors. If what Jay thinks is right, that'll take two of the three computer loci out of action.
Leaving the ship?
She said. General Howard is working on that. If this nest of electronic snakes is about to strike, we need to stop them before they do. Both Jay and John think they might escalate things from pure software attacks to physical attacks on servers and phone companies.
So, I'm the fifth column agent?
No. You leave as scheduled. Finish up, catch the flight back to the mainland. Come home tomorrow.
Alex?
Not open for discussion. If NetForce's military arm has to flex its muscle, that's who does the job, not the assistant deputy commander. She knew he was right. She was a mother. She had a toddler at home. She didn't have any business being on a military raid. She hated thinking like a grown-up. It made her feel old.
In the air over the Central Atlantic, Keller's jet was more than halfway to Miami when he got the frantic call from the train's sysop. German authorities had stopped them for a health inspection, looking for, they said, a carrier of Lasha Valley fever. Trash protocols had been instigated as soon as the police had arrived, the sysop said. The computers on board would be blank before anybody could download anything, all files burned and unrecoverable. Certainly, it would seem suspicious to have that kind of state-of-the-art computer set up on a train, and more suspicious that the machines were all empty. But there would still be nothing the German authorities could charge anybody with that would stick. They could haul everybody in, but no evidence, no case, and all the players knew all they had to do was sit tight and Cybernation's lawyers would eventually spring them. Keller and his crew were safe, and they were what made the programs work. It was scary, but not altogether unexpected when the scrambled call came in from the Japanese sysop a few minutes later. The barge's computers were history, too. That left the ship, and if Gridley and his guys knew about the train and the barge, they had to know about the Bond Chance. Fortunately, the ship was in international waters. If the U.S. could get a Coast Guard cutter or Navy ship to go there, not politically likely, according to Jasmine, the gambling boat's crew would see it coming 15 miles away. Plenty of time to wipe those computers, too, though that would be a last resort. He had better call Jasmine and let her know where he was and what was going on. On the Bond Chance. In her office, Chance was absolutely pissed off. First, there had been Roberto's little routine with that slut of a secretary. Now, there were the goddamn hits on the train and barge, with a terrified Keller on his way back here.
How had they figured it out? Keller had told her it was impossible. The schedule was going to have to be moved up, just in case. They only had one arrow left in their quiver now, and it had to be loosed before their target had a chance to move out of the line of fire. Better to move and win a partial victory than stand still and lose it all.
NetForce HQ, Quantico, Virginia. Howard looked at Julio.
So, what do you think?
Fernandez shook his head.
It's just simple enough, it might work. Gridley can get the computer stuff done?
He says so.
So, if we get approval, we'd go when?
Tomorrow, after dark. Put together three squads. I want 30 troopers, two pilots, and co-pilots. Air transport, briefings, maps, assignments. I need everything ready to roll by 0600 tomorrow.
Yes, sir. I'm on the way. Guess we'll see if the new top kick is as good as he thinks he is.
He can't possibly think he's as good as you thought you were when you were a sergeant.
Well, sir, that's because he couldn't possibly be that good.
On the Bon Chance. Tony wandered around, taking more pictures, but feeling a sense of impending something. No sign of Santos, so maybe his boss had put the fear of God into him. She briefly considered trying to get into the private decks, even went so far as to seem to get lost and wind up at one of the entrances to one such deck. But as she started back the way she'd come, the door opened and revealed a couple of men wearing photographers' sleeveless vests over their shirts, which in this kind of climate meant they were using the vests to cover pistols tucked into their belts. They certainly weren't cold. One more small piece of circumstantial evidence, the armed guards. Of course, maybe they were there to guard a vault room where the gambling winnings were kept. Not likely. Most of what Tony had seen was cashless, all done on credit exchanges. You didn't need guards for that. NetForce HQ.
So, there you have it, boss. I don't have a lot of other history on them, but Santos has been essentially a high-class knee-breaker for a couple of organizations. And Chance, a woman who apparently will do anything to accomplish her goals, has risen up a couple of corporate ladders so fast she seemed to have wings. Add them into the mix, it just keeps getting thicker and thicker. Pretty soon, we have the whole cake.
We're missing a couple of ingredients yet, Michael said. Your friend Keller wasn't on the train. Neither were the others you listed who were supposed to be there.
Jay cursed.
So what now?
I'm expecting a call from the director sometime in the next 5 minutes. If her cloud is enough, we will be sending visitors to the Bon Chance in the very near future.
I bet she named it after herself,
Jay said. Excuse me?
The boat.
Jay blew out a sigh.
Where is Tony?
Michaels looked at his watch. She should be catching a helicopter from the ship about now. In fact, if you can access the passenger lists, I'd appreciate knowing which flight she is on.
No problem. Mary Johnson.
Before Michaels could say anything else, the comm chimed. His secretary said,
The director is on line one.
Michaels reached for the receiver.
Hello.
Commander, we have a go. You'd better be right about this.
Yes, ma'am.
Jay raised an eyebrow.
Michaels nodded at him and raised one hand in a thumbs-up gesture. Jay made a fist and pumped it.
Michaels wished he felt so positive. On the Bon Chance. Tony waited in line for the shuttle boat. The sky had gone gray, and while it wasn't raining yet, the wind had picked up. There was a full load of departing passengers waiting. Apparently, more than a few people were worried about the weather and didn't want to be on a ship 90 miles away from land if it got nasty. The boat from the helicopter barge arrived and tied up at the base of the ramp, and after a few seconds, new arrivals climbed the stairs. Coming up the ramp was a face she recognized. It took a second for her to realize why. Keller. From the picture she'd seen, this was Jay's guy. What was he doing here? He was supposed to be in Germany, wasn't he? This must mean something. As soon as he'd passed,
Tony left the shuttle boat line as if she had suddenly remembered that she had forgotten something. She glanced at her watch. The commsat wasn't due for another 45 minutes. She would wait. There were still a dozen more copters leaving this evening, and she needed to get a better look at this guy, maybe even see where he went or who he might talk to. As if some bored deity had been listening, Tony suddenly saw Jasmine Chance, now dressed in a black jumpsuit and sandals, step into view ahead. Tony turned away and put a hand up to block her face from view. Keller went straight to her, and while she couldn't overhear his conversation, he was obviously pretty excited from the way he waved his hands around. Well, well, what did this mean? Maybe she could find out something more before she had to leave. But she had a problem. Her room was no longer available. She had checked out, and she didn't want to be wandering around the ship towing her suitcase. So when Keller went to a cabin, she ducked into a public toilet nearby, put her suitcase on the commode in an empty stall, locked the door, and climbed out over the top of the stall's door. It would have been smarter to have found a concierge and checked the bag, but she didn't want to get too far away from Keller in case he came out. He did come out, not 10 minutes later. He went straight to one of the guarded entrances to the private decks, and she couldn't follow him there. Okay, he was here. Alex needed that information, and that might be all she was gonna get. It was what it was. When she went back to get her suitcase, it was gone, and her scrambled cell phone and flat screen were in the suitcase. This was not good. Not good at all. Probably housekeeping had the bag. Somebody had reported the stall locked. A janitor had come by, found the bag. Nothing sinister about it. She had her wallet and ID. She could just go and find housekeeping and pick it up. Maybe. Or maybe that wasn't such a good idea. She sat in the stall and thought about the situation. If the suitcase was in the lost and found waiting to be claimed, no problem. But if they had opened it, seen who it belonged to, and wondered why it had been sitting in an empty, locked toilet stall, that might make them curious. It would surely make her curious if she were running security on a ship. Once they saw it wasn't a bomb, they might start to ask themselves other questions. Why on earth would anybody leave their luggage there? What possible reason could there be? The flat screen was clean, no damaging files on it. The cell phone was iffy. They'd have to be real inquisitive to take it apart and discover there was hardware and software built in that scrambled calls, coming or going. But just for the sake of argument, suppose they did that. Mary Johnson goes toddling in to collect her missing bag, and security, in the form of Jasmine Chance, who obviously bore Ms. Mary no love whatsoever for moving in on her Roberto real estate, decides to have a long chat with her. International waters, no constitutional rights, that would be, well, bad. Okay, she decided she would go to ground, find a hidey hole, and stay there, see if Alex showed up. If so, good. If not, she'd worry about that when she got there. Where to hide? She had an idea. Probably the last place they'd look if they decided they needed to find her. Chance called Santos into her office. He came in, a slow stroll, as if he had all the time in the world. She wanted to slap him. Okay, she said. Whatever problems you and I are having, they have to go on hold now. We need to get this done, and we can sort the rest of it out later. He shrugged. Problems? What problems? Santos looked at his watch. He had an hour and a half before he needed to leave. Plenty of time, since he was all packed. Maybe he should go and find that secretary. 15 minutes would be more than enough time to relax them both, no? Why not? He headed for the security cam center. If she was still on board, she would have passed in front of a glass eye recently. He smiled. Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Michael stood in line behind Lieutenant Fernandez, who was behind Jay. General Howard was already on board the Sikorsky.
They all wore touristy civilian clothes and carried assorted sizes and shapes of luggage. The bags were a little heavier than what most tourists would be bringing, but there weren't any metal detectors to pass through before boarding the choppers, so that didn't matter. Everybody in the passenger line was from NetForce. At a different hotel helipad 10 minutes away, another group of NetForce troopers stood in a similar line. Jay had booked them all into 2 flights, making sure nobody else would be on those particular craft but them. Well, except for the copter crews, and they weren't going to be a problem, the general had assured him. They didn't know the passengers were anything other than folks going to gambling. If something unforeseen happened, John had his own pilots who would take over. It was simple enough. They would fly out to the helicopter barge, take the boat from there to the ship, and infiltrate the ship. It was not a direct assault. It was an undercover operation. By the time security on the ship realized it, it ought to be a done deal. Much less likely there'd be any shooting this way, and less chance of civilians getting wounded. A pretty clever idea, actually. Michaels had planned to stay in Quantico and wait until it was over, but Tony's failure to report wouldn't let him do that. He wasn't going to let his people and all their hardware go without him, not as long as Tony was on that ship. The line moved along easily. Michaels climbed the short flight of steps into the craft, found a seat, tucked his bag between his feet, and buckled himself in. John had lent him his body armor vest. It was folded into the bag, along with a plastic handgun and a comm headset. Since he had no active role in the mission, Michaels was supposed to find a secure spot and stay out of the way until the ship was secured. But if trouble popped up, he'd be able to communicate, and he'd have a weapon and some protection. He hoped Tony was all right. Yes, she could take care of herself better than most people, but even so, she wasn't a superwoman. Something could have gone wrong. Probably it was nothing. Weather, crowded flights, her phone on the blink, that was all. But he couldn't help worrying. He loved her. And if she was all right, he didn't care how much she hated it. He was never going to send her into the field like this again. On the Bon Chance. Keller had checked the operations center. Chance's hurry-up was going to cause big problems. His team was good, the best, but they couldn't walk on water. They were at 85-88% readiness, and if Omega launch were tomorrow, they wouldn't be able to improve on that. He had them all running full blast, and as soon as he had a chance to take a shower, get into some fresh clothes, and grab a quick bite, he would be right back there with them. Maybe Santos, the sociopath, and his team of mouth breathers could take up the slack. Not Keller's fault if they couldn't. The door to his cabin stuck. He had to wipe the key card 3 times to get it open. He flipped on the lights, went into the bedroom, and sat on the bed. Took off his shoes, his shirt, and undershirt. He was reaching for his belt buckle when a woman said, "I think that's enough for now." He jerked around so hard he nearly fell down. A short little brunette stood there in t-shirt, jeans, and running shoes. "Who are you? What are you doing in my room?" "Nobody you know, Mr. Keller." "What happened to you? You get caught in a riot?" She nodded at his bruises, which had developed several different shades of brown and purple. "I'm going to call security." She shook her head. "No, I'm afraid you can't do that." He blinked at her. She was, what, 5'2", maybe 120, 25 pounds? He took a step toward the cabin's phone on the bedside table. Somehow, she got between him and the phone and shoved him. He was off-balanced by the little push. He fell on the bed. Screw this. He might get mauled by a man like Santos, but he was not going to be pushed around by some little woman. He jumped up, intending to slap her silly. She ducked the slap and hit him with a brick in the ribs. Before he could recover, she did something to his feet, tripped him, and he fell back on the bed again. He lost it. All the suppressed rage he felt at being used and abused by Chance, and at being assaulted by that trained ape Santos, at being attacked by a woman in his own room, it all exploded. He screamed and leaped at her. He was going to choke the life from her. He came out of grayness, puzzled. He saw a woman sitting next to him. Who was this?
Where was he? His thoughts were sluggish. Had he been in an accident?
Sorry, the woman said.
Part of it came back to him. He was in his cabin on the ship. She had attacked him, hit him with a club.
Who are you? What do you want?
God, he hurt.
It's not important who I am, but I need you to tell me about what you've been up to.
A surge of depression broke over him. This sucked.
He had been beaten by Santos, and now he had been beaten by a woman, a tiny little woman. He was ashamed. He felt himself starting to cry.
It's all right, she said, patting him on the shoulder. I won't hurt you anymore.
That really made things worse. In the air east of Fort Lauderdale, Florida. The Sikorsky's intercom bonged.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is your captain. As you've noticed, we're getting a little weather here, and apparently the conditions are worse at our destination. While we could probably make it just fine, I'd rather not take the risk, so I'm afraid we're going to have to go back to Fort Lauderdale. Sorry for the inconvenience.
With those words, the big helicopter started a slow turn to port.
Howard sighed. Of course. It had been too easy. He looked across the aisle at Julio and nodded. Julio unbuckled his seatbelt, stood, then stepped into the aisle and headed forward. One of the two flight attendants moved to intercept him.
Sir, please take your seat. The captain has the seatbelt sign lit.
Julio reached under his tails-out Hawaiian shirt and pulled his pistol, and hurried forward to have a little chat with the pilot and co-pilot. After a few seconds, the helicopter turned back toward the southeast. Howard motioned to his pilot to go forward. A minute later, Julio marched the co-pilot back and sat him in the vacated seat. He went back to his seat and buckled himself in.
Everything okay, Lieutenant?
All systems green, sir. The captain has decided that cooperation is in his best interest. Since our pilot is in the second chair with a gun, and he's let the captain know he knows how to fly this thing. He wasn't ordered to turn back. It was his decision. ETA is 30 minutes.
On the Bonchance. Santos looked at his watch and frowned. 45 minutes, and no sign of Mary Johnson. He had called and found that she had checked out, but they had shut down the commercial flights back to the mainland, and according to their records, Ms. Johnson had not left yet. So she was here somewhere, and if she wasn't in her room or in the casinos, restaurants, or bars, where was she? Maybe she found a lover. Well, it didn't matter. Pretty soon he would have to leave. Too bad. His comm rang. He pulled it from his belt and opened it.
Yes?
Missy said.
Have you seen Jackson? He's supposed to be in computer operations, and he's not.
Haven't seen him.
And wasn't likely to, if Jackson saw him first.
You try his room?
He's not answering his phone, his pager, or knocks on the door.
Maybe he's getting himself a little pussy. I hear he likes that.
Grow up, Roberto.
There was a short pause.
You'd better get going. The storm is getting worse, and you have to be on the mainland.
Don't worry about me. I'm not gonna disappear like Jackson.
He flipped the phone shut. That was odd, that Keller wasn't around. He lived for his computers. Maybe before he took off, he should check Keller's cabin, make sure he hadn't had a heart attack or something. Tony listened, astounded by the scope of the planned attack on the internet. Keller, once he started, was talking so fast he kept running out of air and had to suck more in big gasps. Hacks, EMP devices, men with guns and cable cutters. This was major. She was going to have to call Alex with this. It was too big to risk letting get started. People were poised to do all this in a few hours, and authorities around the U.S., around the world, had to know. Keller knew some of it, but not all. They needed to get the locations for the attacks on the hardware so they could stop them.
Undoubtedly, those were in the computers. Could Keller access those plans from here? Yes, he could. He had his flat screen. He could download those files. Would she like him to do it? Tony smiled. This would justify her staying here.
Do it.
It didn't take that long. When he was done, he burned the download into a mini DVD and ejected it from the machine. Tony took it. She would call Alex right now. If he wasn't on the way, this would be important enough to scramble a military copter and get help here.
You did good, Jackson. Now, just sit there for a minute while I make a call.
As she reached for the phone, somebody knocked on the cabin's door.
Jackson, you in there, boy? Open up.
Santos.
No, go away,
Keller yelled before Tony could stop him. Uh-oh, they were in trouble now. It was dark. The wind rocked the copter, and the rain was coming down pretty steady.
There it is, Howard said.
Michaels looked through the window. A smear of bright light shined through the darkness, the helicopter barge. Past that, at least half a mile or so, he'd guessed, was the gambling ship, also lit up like a Christmas tree. Fernandez lurched back from the front of the copter.
Landing is going to be tricky. They said we're going to have to ride this storm out tied to the deck, 'cause they ain't running the transport boats. It's pretty choppy out there.
Howard grinned.
Oh, I'm sure we can convince them to let us use the shuttle boat if we ask real politely.
The copter dropped lower, spiraling in toward the landing barge. The deck didn't look very big from here, kind of like a postage stamp. The helicopter bounced and jerked to the left, then back to the right and caught another wind shear that dropped them like a stone.
Hang on, folks, the captain said. We're going in.
On the Bonchance. Tony had, she figured, about 2 seconds before Santos came through the door, either by using a passkey card or by kicking it down. He knew Keller was in here. Keller was a quivering lump on the bed, but she didn't want to go one-on-one with Santos, not in a space as cramped as this cabin. Maybe she could take him, maybe not. He was big, strong, fit, and trained, and she couldn't risk losing the data she had gotten from Keller. What to do? The moment of panic flared, but then her brain started working. She realized that Santos didn't know who she was or what she was doing in Keller's cabin. She grabbed her shirt, pulled it off, then peeled off her sports bra. She held them in one hand, loosely covered her breasts, and hurried to the door. Santos was about to kick the door when it opened. A half-naked woman stood there. The secretary? She was here with Keller? What god had he pissed off that this man, this picaflor, was sleeping with two of his women? That was it. He was going to kill the guy.
Roberto, what are you doing here?
I need to talk to Keller. He's supposed to be working, but I guess I can see why not. No wonder I couldn't find you.
He's putting his clothes on in there.
Yes. Well, you wait right here. I got something for you.
He cupped his groin.
Bigger and harder than anything Keller has.
She smiled at him, moved her hand with the shirt in it out of the way, and took a deep breath.
Ah, nice mambas.
Oh, yeah. This would have to be quick, but he could do that. Get Keller out of here pronto and get back to her. Leave Missy with a little something to think about. He'd make sure Keller told her about it. He was already halfway ready as he moved past her through the short hall toward the bedroom. Tony ran. She sprinted past a couple in the hall, saw the man grin at her. Well, a half-naked woman running down the hall was probably not something they saw every day. By the time Santos realized something was wrong, she wanted to be far away. She had to find another hiding place, fast.
The rain slashed down, and the blue and white striped canvas roof on the shuttle boat didn't do much to keep the people under it dry. Michaels was soaked, as were the other tourists. Next to him, Howard yelled,
"I've left the pilots watching the crews of the two birds and two other troopers guarding the barge crew. They just developed serious radio and comm trouble."
As the boat rocked and pitched and slogged through the 4-foot seas, Michael's Virgil buzzed against his hip. He grabbed the unit. The caller number ID didn't mean anything, and the little screen was blank, no visual. He held it to his ear so he could hear better.
"Hello?"
"Alex, it's me. Tony."
"Babe, what?"
"Where are you?"
she cut in.
"On a boat heading for the ship. We'll be there in 5 minutes."
"Thank God. Listen, I'm on a public phone. Jay was right about everything. The balloon goes up tomorrow. I've got all the details. I'll call again later, but right now, I gotta go. I love you."
She discommed. A malignant worm roiled in his gut.
"What?"
Howard said. Tony, she's in some kind of trouble, enough to risk calling on an open line. She says she's got the evidence we need."
"My God."
"Hurry this thing up," Michael said. Howard made a hand signal. The boat's engine roared louder, but it didn't seem to move any faster. Santos couldn't figure it out for a second when he saw Keller lying on the bed. What? Had she screwed him stupid? He was just lying there, curled up in a ball. Was he afraid Santos was going to beat him again?
"Keller. Keller."
The man whimpered.
"Don't. I didn't mean to."
Santos strode to the bed and grabbed Keller by the hair, jerking him up.
"What are you whining about?"
"I didn't mean to. She beat me. She made me tell her."
"Tell her what?"
"About Omega."
Santos let go of Keller's hair and slapped him with his free hand, but only once, then ran back to where he had left the woman. She was gone, of course. He looked out into the hall. No sign of her. Santos pulled his comm from his belt and thumbed the emergency button.
"This is Santos," he said when security answered. "There's a woman on board. Short, black hair, maybe 28-30. Calls herself Mary Johnson. Dressed in jeans, running shoes, a black t-shirt. Find her. Find her now."
The officer at the boat moorage looked at the boat with its drenched tourists.
"You must be crazy to come across in weather like this. Somebody's head's gonna roll."
He looked at the boat's pilot.
"And who the hell are you? Where is Marty? This is his shift."
The pilot grinned and shoved his Walther pistol into the officer's belly. "Marty got sick. If you behave yourself, you won't catch what he's got." The officer froze.
"Let's move it, people," Fernandez said.
Michaels was first up the ladder. Tony had solved the problem of where to hide. She slipped into a passenger cabin, saw a maid cleaning the room, and stepped into the bathroom. In Spanish, Tony called out,
"Hey, you can leave that. Come back later, please, okay?"
The maid said, "Está bien, señora," and left. Once the maid was gone, Tony checked out the cabin. No computer, so she couldn't try to upload the disk into a NetForce receptacle or even some friend's mailbox. Damn. She couldn't stay here long, she knew. Santos would have put out an alarm by now. But the ship was rigged with surveillance cams all over, and she didn't want to let one of those see her. Alex had said he'd be here in a few minutes. If they were about to start some kind of operation, all she had to do was stay hidden until it was done. That was all. Michaels looked at his watch. In 10 minutes, everybody on the assault team was supposed to be in position. In 14 minutes, everybody would be on their specially augmented Losir headsets, and 60 seconds later, they would pull guns, fire off explosive charges that would blow open secured doors, and in theory, take over the ship before anybody could wipe the computers. He had already slipped his headset from the bag John Howard had given him and had it tucked away in his shirt pocket, ready to go. But where was Tony? Michaels went below decks and wandered the halls, looking,
There were some security types with headcoms of their own moving around purposefully, and he was sure they were looking for Tony. Or maybe they were looking for tourists carrying bags. He slipped the bag with the gun in it behind a potted plant as two of the men approached him. Unfortunately, one of them spotted the bag.
"This yours?"
Michaels looked at them.
"What? Never saw it before."
One of the guards picked up the bag. Alex didn't want them opening it. Quickly, he said,
"Hey, you looking for a little brunette?"
The man about to open the bag stopped so suddenly he almost fell.
"You've seen her?"
"Yeah, she came out on the deck, back by the swimming pool."
"Thank you, sir."
The man took off, talking into his comm. That would help, Michaels thought, as long as Tony wasn't hiding out at the swimming pool. But this was bad. He looked at his watch. 12 minutes. Santos didn't know what was going on, but he knew the little secretary was not what she pretended to be. She was a spy, and if Keller had rolled over and given up the operation, he had to tell Missy. When he found her in his office and did, she was not pleased.
"What? We've got to find her before she can get any of this off the ship. Find her, Roberto."
Howard looked at his watch, then at Jay Gridley.
"Stay behind me."
"Don't worry about that."
Howard adjusted the spider silk vest under his still wet Hawaiian shirt. It was too tight, but that's what he got for letting Michaels have his and using one of the spares. He loosened the side tabs a little. Better. On the minute, Howard and Jay both pulled their augmented low-sir-com headsets from their packs and slipped them on.
"Don't forget your nose plugs," he said.
Jay nodded, touched his nostrils, already in.
"This is Howard. We are still on."
Howard stepped to the card reader, put a strip of plastic explosive onto it, and waved Jay back. He looked at his watch, counted down the seconds.
4, 3, 2, 1. Now.
The card reader flashed like a strobe and exploded. After a beat, the door slid open and two armed guards jumped out, waving pistols. Howard sprayed them with emetic foam. Thick white billows of the stuff enveloped the pair. They both screamed and both started retching. Even as the guards fell, he was moving.
"Go, go."
Jay was right behind him. Michaels heard Howard over the headset, then felt the small explosions through his shoes and knew the teams had begun their assault on the computer decks. It would take only a few seconds, and with luck, they'd be able to shut down the computers before they destroyed their information. Santos was about to open the door of the room where the Cuban maid had seen a woman come in when his comm buzzed.
"What?"
"Sir, we have some kind of trouble below decks. There's a...
Ow!" "What? What?"
Santos heard the sound of somebody vomiting noisily. He snapped the comm shut. The woman? Or her friends? Whatever, it was serious. He headed toward the stairs. He'd better see what was going on. He rounded a corner in the corridor and saw two men in Hawaiian shirts heading away from him. They were dressed as tourists, but they wore comm headsets and carried submachine guns. He could see what looked like body armor under their wet shirts. Not his people. He pulled back out of sight, grabbed his comm, triggered the emergency caller. There was no answer. Either his people were too busy to answer, which was not likely, or the ship's communication system had been shut down. Neither was good for him. He knew what had happened. The spy had arranged to get her people on board. The place was done. If he hung around, he was going to be done too. It was time to leave this party. If he could get to the launch, he could escape. The cigarette boat had a couple hundred miles of range, easy. In the storm, nobody would see him, and the cigarette could outrun anything afloat in these waters. Yes, he needed to go. Now. But as he cut up and through the gym, he came across another tourist with a headset. Fortunately, this one wasn't holding a gun.
"You're Santos."
"That's right. And who are you?"
"I'm a federal agent. You're under arrest. Sit down and put your hands on top of your head.
Santos laughed.
Chance realized when the comm system shut down that something grave had happened. She saw men with guns, and she knew instantly that the ship was under assault. Her people weren't prepared for that, not a full-out military attack. That had never been in the cards. Now, it would come down to lawyers and money. CyberNation would take care of her. She had seen to that. But her insurance to that end might be a liability if it fell into the wrong hands. Best she attend to that. Right now.
Michael stared at the man. The ship's gym was a fair-sized room with wall-to-wall mirrors and a thick carpet. Exercise machines around the perimeter and mostly open in the center. Santos circled around a treadmill and leaped into a dive at the floor, hit on his hands, and did a front handspring directly toward him. Michaels had never seen anything like this. Despite his training to go in when attacked, however, Michaels sectored off to his right, and the heel missed his nose by an inch. A good move, it turned out. If he'd gone in, he would have eaten it. What the hell was this? Some kind of demented gymnastics? The black man landed on his feet, then twirled around into a crouch facing Michaels. He danced from side to side, raising and lowering himself from almost upright into a full squat and back as if he were some kind of a crazed jack-in-the-box. Reflections of Santos matched him in the floor-to-ceiling mirrors. This was surreal, like something out of a Bruce Lee movie. Michaels kept himself angled at 45 degrees, left foot forward, one hand covering high line, the other low line, not moving.
What kind of crooked stance is that? Santos asked, grinning. Not karate, not jujutsu, not for sure capoeira.
Capoeira. That rang a bell. It was the South American fighting style the African slaves either created or brought with them from the old continent to the New World. Acrobatic stuff, but that was pretty much all he knew about it. He had heard Tony talk about it. That would fit. Santos was from Brazil.
Welcome to El Jogo, Homem Branco.
The man leaped up and did a backflip, landed easily, one foot hitting before the other, 1-2. He laughed. Michaels felt another moment of panic.
Get a grip here.
Santos shuffled to Michaels' right, almost as if dancing. Michaels didn't move. Let him dance. He wasn't doing any damage out there. Santos jinked in, just at the edge of kicking range, then jumped back, trying to draw the attack. Michaels held his ground. The black man smiled.
You know something, don't you, Mr. White Man, federal agent? But what is it, White? How well does it work?
Come and find out.
Oh, yes, I will.
Santos shuffled the other way, stepped in and feinted a high kick outside Michael's range. Michael stayed where he was.
You waiting for me to make a mistake?
Whenever you're ready.
Santos laughed. Then he twirled and whirled and dropped, spun into a kind of crabbed cartwheel, and somehow ate up the space between them. His kick was low, and while Michaels dropped his stance, turned, and managed to get a sweeping block down, the kick was too powerful to do more than slightly deflect it. It glanced off his thigh instead of hitting it square on, but it still hurt even in passing. Michaels should have blocked it, but it wasn't major. The goal here was not so much to win as it was to not lose. The winner was the guy who got to go home under his own steam. Santos shifted back and forth from foot to foot.
Not bad for an old man. What you call this, Bronco?
Bronco must mean white.
Does it matter?
Just curious. Always looking to educate myself more.
I'll tell you all about it after we're done. Maybe you can find a teacher in prison.
Santos laughed, a deep belly rumble.
That's funny. You expecting to be around after we're done? No way. Tell me now.
Michaels took a deep breath. He let half of it out. Relax, Alex, he said quietly to himself.
The days he'd practiced the mental exercise Tony had showed him paid off. He dropped lower, with just enough tension to stay upright. His breathing deepened, and he felt much looser. Considering his current situation, this was more than passing extraordinary.
Santos raised an eyebrow.
What did you just do there, Mr. Federal Agent?
Michael smiled. Bring your pretty little dance closer and see. It was, Tony had always taught him, good Selah to bait an opponent. Maybe it would make him angry enough to lose control, do something stupid.
I will. Don't you worry.
Santos whirled and did some kind of acrobatic twist, ending in a back fist at Michael's head. Michael stepped in, his right fist covering his face, and did a block hit. Santos leaned away, slipping the punch, but not quite enough. Michael's got one knuckle solidly into the other man's forehead. Santos backed off, shook his head.
Good one. I like this stuff you do. It's tight, no wasted moves. Come on. Tell me what it is. Tell me, in case you aren't able to afterward.
Don't worry about that.
But he was worried about it. Michaels wished he had a knife. A tank would be useful, too. Santos laughed.
You worried, Bronco?
Nah, I just don't want to be late for dinner. You're the one who should be worried.
See, I know what your dance is. It's capoeira.
You don't know what I'm gonna do.
Santos flew at him.
The wound was minor. The handgun bullet had punched a hole through Howard's side exactly where the vest tab left a tiny gap between the front and side panels. A freak shot. What you got for not using your own gear. The man who'd shot him had taken Howard's return fire square in the middle of his chest. He hadn't been wearing a vest.
General, Gridley said, you okay?
I've hurt myself worse shaving. I'll put a Band-Aid on it when I get a minute.
The voice on the low-seer was Julio's.
We had the ship secure, General.
Howard laughed. He had never felt more alive. Risk was a part of life. He knew that now. And this was what he did, who he was. He was a man of war, a soldier. Death came to all eventually, but he couldn't stop living in the meanwhile.
Good work, Lieutenant. Where are you?
With the computers, Deck D, amidships.
We'll see you in a few minutes. Discom.
Gridley shook his head.
I'm gonna stop going out with you. Last time I nearly got killed by some psycho drug fiend in California. This fieldwork gets old fast.
You got a fix on the commander?
Gridley looked at his Virgil.
Yeah, his Virgil is about 150 feet that way, he pointed. But I can't get an altitude on him. He could be on the top deck or down below.
Let's go find him. Our squads will mop up the rest of these bozos. Stay behind me.
You don't have to tell me that twice. Saji would never forgive me if I messed up the wedding by getting myself killed.
Howard headed past the row of slot machines and toward the blackjack tables. There was a corridor past those that led through a kitchen to a cafeteria. Michaels would have to be past that, according to Gridley's GPS sig. He brought up the briefing map in his mind's eye. Past that, on this level, was a stairway leading up and down. Up was the main deck. Down was a gymnasium. There was an access to the locked-off computer deck that way, too.
Just ahead,
Jay said.
Howard nodded. I'll go through first. Try not to shoot me in the back.
Jay laughed. Santos twirled in, and it was all Michaels could do to cover as a quick series of punches bounced off his arms, shoulders, and one against the side of his head that cracked him into a blinding flash of red. The man had fists like rocks. Michaels felt for Santos, not using his eyes, but his body. He threw his knee and right elbow, caught a hip with the knee, the side of the man's neck with the elbow. Not pretty, but enough to back him off.
Santos shook his head, whirled around, stepped out of range.
I thought I had you then. Good recovery. Now we having fun. Your head okay, Bronco?
Michaels was still rattled from the head punch, but he couldn't let that show.
Is that the best you got?
Santos managed a smile as he circled, spiraling slightly inward.
Best I got? I'm not even warmed up yet. I am younger, stronger, faster, and more skilled. You have enough of your game to see this, no?
Damn straight about that. He was better than Michaels, and he knew it. He wasn't going full out. He was playing as if this was a friendly sparring match. Michaels was in trouble here.
Well, wasn't that what Sealot was supposed to train you for? To stay with somebody who was stronger, faster, and as well-trained?
Yeah, but this guy was some kind of world-class fighter. Sealot would let you keep up with most people, but it didn't make you invincible, certainly not at his level of ability. But there was one thing he had going for him, and maybe he could stall the guy long enough for that to happen. Michael circled to his left, staying low.
You want to hear a story?
Santos flashed a smile.
Is it a funny story?
I think so.
Go ahead. I need a good laugh. Been a bad day.
They circled, each to his left. Once upon a time, there was a gathering of animals in the woods. They talked about the rain, the sunshine, the state of the world. At one point, the talk turned to which creature was the most deadly in the forest, and Tiger proclaimed that he was the most dangerous animal.
Really? Dog said. Why is that?
Tiger laughed. Just look at me. Compared to you, I am bigger, stronger, and faster. I could break your neck with a single swipe of my paw. Is this not true?
It is true, Dog admitted.
Well, then you agree that I am the deadliest animal in the forest.
Maybe not, Dog said.
This angered Tiger greatly, and he roared with displeasure.
So you say I am not the deadliest animal. Who is then, you?
Not me, Dog said. Tell me now, or I will kill you. And he reared up and prepared to leap on Dog. But before he could attack, there came an explosion, and Tiger suddenly fell over dead. There behind the animal stood Man, smoke curling from the muzzle of a rifle. And Dog smiled his dog smile and said, I am not the deadliest animal in the forest, but I have a friend.
Santos smiled.
That's not such a funny story, Bronco.
Oh, I don't know, came a voice from behind him. I thought it was pretty good.
Santos stepped back and half spun. A black man, another tourist, not a tourist, stood there, aiming a handgun at him. A second man stood behind him. He had a gun, too.
Commander, the newly arrived black man said.
General, I am extremely glad to see you.
Santos glared at Bronco.
You cheated.
Alex smiled.
Yes, cheating is good, Sealot. That's the art I practice, by the way. Pukulan, Pencak, Sealot, Sirak, from Indonesia.
Ah,
Santos knew of the Indonesian forms.
Where is your skirt?
It's a sarong, not a skirt.
Santos leaped, turned the jump into a dive and roll, and as he came up, made that into another dive. The gun went off, but a hair slow. The bullet burned across his back, the lightest of touches, a graze, that was all. There was a large sealed window looking into the hallway just ahead of him. The gun boomed again, and the bullet hit the glass in front of him, punched through, and spiderwebbed the glass with fractures. Good. He launched himself at the cracked plate head first, hands and forearms up to cover his face. Hit! He flew through the window in a spray of glass shards, tucked, rolled, hit the carpeted floor, came up, too much momentum, slammed into the corridor's far wall. He grunted, pushed off, and L stepped away, shoving hard with his left foot, moving to his right as the third bullet punched through the wall where he had been a quarter second ago. But now he was moving down the hall, ducking low and gaining speed. In two heartbeats, he was out of the line of fire. He reached a juncture, cut to his right, and kept sprinting.
He laughed loudly. They would never catch him from behind. He would find a way off this ship. Cybernation might be mortally wounded, but that did not matter. He would get away. He would go home. He would count his money and have the last laugh. But first, there was one small piece of business he needed to finish.
Chance had the pistol and the disc with the blackmail insurance on it. She didn't know how many of the invaders were on the ship, or if her people had had time to wipe the computers, but she would have time enough to destroy the disc. If they caught her, Cybernation's lawyers would get her out of jail, and once that happened, she would disappear. She had half a dozen false identities ready for use, money stashed under those names. This was a big loss, but she would survive. She could start over, under another name, work her way back up. It might even be fun, that kind of challenge. She couldn't risk hiding the disc. They might take this ship down to the waterline, and if they found it, Cybernation would suffer a major, maybe even a killing blow. The files were damning. Names, dates, places, a criminal prosecutor's dream. She had done it to protect herself in case Cybernation decided she was no longer worth having around. But now, she needed their help, and anything that hurt them might hurt her. She hurried down the corridor toward her office. Tony came out of the room. There were a score of tourists who were puzzled and upset.
What's going on? Somebody said.
Pirates, a fat man answered. We've been taken over by hijackers.
Tony smiled.
What's funny, lady?
A bald man with a bad complexion said.
You think being hijacked by pirates is funny?
It's not pirates. It's just my husband, come to rescue me.
She smiled again and started toward the stairs. Boy, this was going to be a great story to tell little Alec someday.
I never saw anybody move like that, Jay said.
Did you hit him? The boss asked.
John Howard shook his head.
Not so you'd notice. He a gymnast?
Capoeira, the boss said.
South American fighting art. Well, get him, Howard said. We have the ship.
As they were heading toward the stairs, Tony appeared. Michaels nearly knocked her down. He grabbed her so hard. They hugged, spun in a circle. Jay could feel the relief coming off both of them. Tony held up a mini DVD.
The plans for the attack on the net. They ramped things up. You need to get these locations to the appropriate authorities.
Howard took the disc.
Yes, ma'am, although they won't be doing anything from here. We control this vessel.
You collected Santos and Jasmine Chance?
Not yet, but we will.
He's a dangerous man.
Tell me about it, the boss said. Santos saw that the door to Missy's office was closed, and when he got to it, he found it locked. She wasn't in her room, and he didn't think she would be trying to hide on the ship. No, she'd be here, and likely working on some scheme to save her beautiful ass. He touched the door, stepped back. He hit it with his shoulder and slammed it open.
Roberto, what are you doing?
She had a cigarette lighter in one hand, a small pistol in the other. Something was burning in the ashtray on her desk.
Come to pay my respects, Missy, leaving you a little gift before I retire.
What are you talking about? We don't have time for this.
Your left leg, I think. Just above the knee. I think that would balance us. I wasn't so rough on Jackson. But it wasn't really his fault, was it? When your woman screws another man, she is the one who is responsible. You will have plenty of time to think on it when you are propped up in the cast, waiting to heal.
She raised the gun.
You've lost your mind. I'm not going to just stand here and let you break my leg.
She dropped the cigarette lighter and grabbed the pistol with her other hand, aimed right at his chest.
If you shoot, I will break your neck instead. A leg is not so bad.
He took another step. She shot him.
The noise didn't seem all that loud, and the impact of the bullet, high and to his right, didn't hurt. It was like being hit with a finger poke. Nothing, really. He leaped. Chance pulled the trigger, again and again, until the pistol clicked empty. She saw the holes appear in Santos' body, his chest, belly, one in his outstretched hand, but he kept coming. She tried to leap out of the way, but he caught her around the waist. She hammered at his head with the butt of the pistol, watched the bright red blood gush, but he dragged her down, slammed her back against the floor.
Roberto, don't!
She kept hammering at his head, saw him grinning through the blood streaming down his face. He slid his hand up her body, caught her by the throat. He squeezed, his big fingers biting into the vessels of her neck. Her sight went gray.
Please, don't!
Goodbye, Missy.
He leaned down and kissed her. His blood dripped into her face. She tried to blink it away. Then it all faded. His smile was the last thing she saw. Santos held his grip on her neck for a long time after her eyes rolled back in their sockets. When he finally let go, he was sure she was gone. Too bad for her. He tried to push himself up and away from her, but he had never felt so weak. He collapsed across her body, his face next to hers. Who would get all his money, he wondered. That was his last thought. In the bowels of the ship, the Cybernation programmers and security people had panicked. They hadn't done as good a job as they had on the train and barge. The men spraying puke foam and blasting flashbangs had moved too fast. There would be evidence here.
Jay?
Already on it. He moved to an undamaged console and sat. Tony stood behind him, watching. From behind them, Julio Fernandez said, General. He came in, leading a couple of troopers.
Been taking a nap, Lieutenant?
Something I think you and the commander want to take a look at. Hey, Tony. Nice to see you're okay.
Nice to be okay, Julio.
Howard nodded.
Lead on, Lieutenant.
Michaels and Tony followed Howard and Fernandez up a short flight of stairs and down a corridor. In an office on the floor were two dead people, Jasmine Chance and Roberto Santos. Michael shook his head.
Lord, what happened?
Julio said, Way I see it is, he came at her, she blasted him, he lived long enough to choke her out. Aiuchi, the Japanese call it. Mutual slaying.
My God, Howard said. Mean people.
Not anymore, Michaels said. The wedding had been beautiful. Now at the reception, Saji had gone to change into her traveling clothes. Jay had already shed his tux and dressed in his usual laid-back style. Tony stood next to Alex, who looked very James Bondish in his black tuxedo. John Howard and his wife Nadine were nearby, as were Julio Fernandez and his wife Joanna. Julio held his squirming son, who apparently wanted to get down and destroy the place in a terrible two frenzy, something Tony could look forward to with little Alex. Saji's mother hugged her sister, crying. Jay's parents wiped away tears and beamed at their son from across the room. Jay came over to shake Alex's hand.
Thanks for everything, boss.
You feeling better about this now? Tony said, waving at the interior of the church's reception area.
Oh, yeah. Just cold feet was all. I love her. I can't see that stopping.
Off to Bali, right? Alex said.
Yep. Sun, sand, drinks with fruits and flowers in them. The whole enchilada. We're going to make a pass by Thailand on the trip back. See some of my distant relatives, too.
That's great, Jay.
If you're sure you can get by without me, that is.
We'll manage. With the train, barge, and boat out of commission, I don't think those folks will be causing us any more trouble for at least a little while, Alex said.
But they were only wounded, not killed. They can blame somebody, offer him up as a scapegoat, keep going.
Alex shrugged. You take what you can.
You sorry you didn't get a chance to go head-to-head with Keller?
Tony asked.
Yes and no. It would have been great for the old ego to kick his ass up and down the block, but he's in jail, an emotional wreck. Besides, what could I do that would make him feel worse than getting the bejesus beat out of him by a girl?
She smiled. She looked up and saw Guru, dressed in a formal sarong and sandals, carrying the baby. Guru came over and stood next to Jay as Saji reappeared, dressed in her traveling suit. She smiled at Jay.
I think that's my cue, Jay said.
They left, amidst a hail of tossed birdseed. Better than rice, because it wouldn't hurt the birds to eat any that didn't get swept up. As the limo drove away, Tony turned to Alex.
So romantic. A trip to Bali, don't you think?
Hey, we had Hawaii just as nice. You complaining?
Not me.
She took his arm.
Now we're to the good part.
Oh?
Yep. And they lived happily ever after.
He laughed, and she joined him.
We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio. To order additional cassettes or CDs, or to receive a complete catalog of Harper Audio and Cadman titles, please call us at 1-800-331-3761. You might also try our website, www.harperaudio.com. Thank you.